And now, Stein Online presents Mark Stein on the Town.
Occasionally, I'm asked by someone or other to pick out my all-time top 10 records, my Desert Island Discs, as they'd say at the BBC. And I can't really do it. My favourite songs, but they come and go. I have favourite composers, but they go up and down the rankings. I have favourite singers, but again, they vary from one year to the next. There is, however, a sound I wouldn't want to be without. It's a man and his clarinet. Artie Shaw, born 100 years ago, May 23rd, 1910, in New York City. He covered the waterfront and he covered pretty much everything else in the course of a long life. He played, he conducted, he wrote music, he wrote novels. He was an advanced mathematician, a precision marksman, an expert fly fisherman. But the reason we mark his centenary is because, for an all too brief part of his 94 years, he played clarinet better than anybody on the planet. In 1938, he signed a contract with RCA Victor, and at the very first session, he recorded a song they didn't want him to do, an unknown song from a forgotten Broadway show from three seasons back. Shaw's record got to number one that September of 1938. So what? A lot of records get to number one over the years. But almost three quarters of a century on, the opening bars of this one are as wild and exciting and unmistakable as anything in American music. Bum! Da 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 dun da dun. Bum! Bum! Da 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 dun da dun. And suddenly, there's Artie Shaw. Artie Shaw made Begin the Begin a hit, all 108 bars of it, the longest standard in the standard repertoire, thanks to Shaw. Cole Porter wrote it as a piece of faux exotic, and down by the shore an orchestra's playing, and even the palms seemed to be swaying. But Artie Shaw threw out the lyric and made the tune jump. The double thwack of those opening bars has nothing to do with Cole Porter. Just a little figure Shaw and his arranger Jerry Gray cooked up as a warm-up for the clarinet. You don't have to do it like that. You can play it a thousand different ways. It's the Andrews Sisters, Mario Lanza, Pete Townsend, Julio Iglesias, Sheryl Crow have all done over the years. But Artie Shaw's recording opened the way for all the others. The composer certainly understood.
Cole Porter, beginning, was done with a beat, not the way he wrote it. Cole shook hands with me and he said that to meet his, happy to meet his collaborator.
Jazz critic Gene Leese, who died a couple of weeks ago, described the big bands of the late 30s and early 40s as, quote, the sound that will not go away. For Artie Shaw, restless and obsessive, that was the problem. So he went away instead. He started quitting the music business, quote, permanently, a few months after its first hit, and he kept on quitting it. But every time he came back, the fans were still there demanding the same old songs. He found out it was one thing to begin the begin and quite another to try and stop it. Every time someone comes up to me and says, "Oh, Mr. Shaw, I love Begin the Begin," he told me, "I want to vomit." Sorry, I said to him, but I do love Begin the Begin. Well then, you make me want to vomit, he said. We heard a bit of Shaw just a moment ago. I interviewed him a couple of times formally and met him a couple more times informally over the years, and we'll hear some more from the archives in the course of this centenary salute. But I never really got a satisfactory answer as to how someone so good at what he does can just put down his instrument, as Shaw did with his clarinet in 1954, and never pick it up again for the next half century. He was the first big band leader to get out of the biz, ahead of Tommy Dorsey, Duke Ellington, Harry James, and he wound up outliving them all, the last survivor. We think of them as musicians now, and a few of them, very few according to Shaw, were great artists. But for anyone under a certain age, it's hard to comprehend the scale of their celebrity. They were instrumentalists in tuxedos, fronting orchestras, and yet they were as big as the biggest movie stars. Imagine Britney Spears or Lady Gaga if she could play a clarinet brilliantly. On the eve of World War II, Time magazine reported that to Germans, America meant, quote, skyscrapers, Clark Gable and Artie Shaw. And Shaw lived more like a movie star than Gable did. In the ranks of legendary heterosexuals, he's rivaled only by Sinatra when it comes to the number of A-list Hollywood babes he got to see in non-Hays Code situations. He was engaged to Betty Grable when he ran off with Lana Turner. He married Ava Gardner and had an affair with Rita Hayworth. Among his eight wives were Evelyn Keyes, who played Mrs. Al Jolson in The Jolson Story, and Kathleen Windsor, the best-selling naughty novelist of Forever Amber, and Betty Kern, daughter of Jerome Kern, composer of Showboat and much else. Shaw was, by all accounts, a difficult husband, but what a son-in-law. However he treated Betty Kern, he treated his father-in-law just fine. Here's Artie Shaw playing Jerry Kern. Days of mad romance and love. Artie Shaw loomed large with fictional gals too. Most fans of P.G. Wodehouse regard his literary landscape as a timeless playground sealed off from reality. Mr. Wodehouse's world can never stale, as Evelyn Waugh put it. A quote, he has made a world for us to live in and delight in. But Artie Shaw was so ubiquitous at the height of his fame that he has the distinction of being one of the few real, live, flesh-and-blood contemporaries to invade the Wodehouse canon. In the novel The Mating Season, a Hollywood starlet recounts to Bertie Wooster her encounter with an elderly English spinster who turns out to be something of a movie fan. Quote, she knows exactly how many times everybody's been divorced and why, how much every picture for the last 25 years has grossed, and how many Warner Brothers there are. She even knows how many times Artie Shaw has been married, which I'll bet he couldn't tell you himself. She asked if I had ever been married to Artie Shaw, and when I said no, seemed to think I was pulling her leg or must have done it without noticing. I tried to explain that when a girl goes to Hollywood, she doesn't have to marry Artie Shaw, it's optional, but I don't think I convinced her. When he stopped marrying, he started lecturing on it at colleges. Quote, consecutive monogamy and ideal divorce by an ex-husband of love goddesses. These love goddesses are not what they seem, especially if you're married to one, he explained. They all think they want a traditional marriage, but they aren't made for that sort of thing. Somebody's got to get the coffee in the morning, and an Ava Gardner isn't going to do that. So you get up and get it, and then you find you're doing everything. And why? Because she's the love goddess, and that's all she has to be. He had children with a couple of them, but didn't care much for them either. I didn't get along with the mothers, he said, so why should I get along with the kids? Ba-ba-o, ba-ba-o. Ba-ba-o, ba-ba-o. Artie Shaw started life as the son of a Jewish tailor who made his way to Ellis Island, Tsarist Russia.
Here's an ancient Russian story that sings of love in all its glory. It's called Proshchai, which means goodbye, goodbye, don't cry. I'll soon be returning to you. Don't cry, dearest one, Proshchai.
Proshchai. So a Russian Jew called Arshosky bids farewell to the old country, makes his way to New York, and meets and marries an Austrian immigrant called Sarah Strauss. Their son, Arthur Jacob Arshosky, is born in New York City in May 1910 and spends his first 7 years in a basement flat on the Lower East Side. And then his father's business goes bankrupt and the family move to New Haven, Connecticut. Young Artie dodges the piano lessons his mama wants him to take, but he dabbles in the ukulele. And then one day, around about the age of 13, he goes to the local vaudeville house, Polly's Palace Theatre on Church Street. And a man in a striped blazer and straw hat gets down on one knee and plays on the saxophone a big hit of the day, Dreamy Melody. Artie was smitten. He got a summer job at Gorn's Delicatessen so he could earn enough for a C major saxophone from Vroxina's music shop. And when he eventually bought it, he practiced 8 hours a day.
When you first saw that vaudevillian on stage as a kid playing the saxophone...
See, that seemed very glamorous to me at the time. Now I look back, it's kind of ludicrous. I mean, if I did that now, I'd be being campy.
Yeah.
Put on a blazer and a straw hat and get down on one knee and play Dreamy Melody. But to my perceptions at 15 or 14, that was glamour with a capital G.
You, in a way, you're not one of these people who ever was pushed into the music business. You more or less picked up an instrument voluntarily.
Yeah, but I was pushed into it by my background, my environment. Mm-hmm. I mean, by my needs to become somebody, end quote.
Yes.
And, you know, I finally became somebody. You know, beware of what you wish for. You might get it. And then you find what you wanted was not what you wanted.
September 1938, other band leaders had theme tunes like Moonlight Serenade and I'm Getting Sentimental Over You, but that was Artie Shaw's unmistakable signature. A tune called Nightmare, cooked up a few hours before his band's first ever radio broadcast from the Hotel Lexington in New York, because he'd left it too late to cut a deal with some music publisher to use whatever song the pluggers were pushing. From Dreamy Melody to Nightmare in fewer steps than you might expect. 70 years on, you wonder quite what was so nightmarish about it all. Betty Grable, Lana Turner, Rita Hayworth, Ava Gardner. Ah, but the celebrity broads were a rare compensation in a world where everything else was a pain in the neck. Artie Shaw was a swing band leader, but he hated the word swing, and he was a jazz musician, but he hated the word jazz. He resented singers, he despised dancers, and he loathed fans. The audience were, quote, morons, and the musicians were, quote, prima donnas, and the ones who weren't were hacks who did that cheesy synchronized swaying with the saxes and the trombones that the morons were dumb enough to go crazy for. As for his fellow band leaders, Glenn Miller, quote, it would have been better if he'd lived and his music had died. Now how about Benny Goodman? Musically, he had a limited vocabulary, sniffed Shaw. Of the best band leaders of the period were clarinetists Shaw, Benny Goodman, Woody Herman, and it seems to me that's the core sound of the era, so seductive, so insinuating. Artie, naturally, had no time for that kind of talk. According to him, the executives liked the clarinet because in those days of primitive recording, its higher pitch made it cut through the band more clearly than the sax did. Whatever. Digitally remastered and cleaned up, the arrangements still sound good. On his smash 1940 recording of Stardust, Shaw's solo manages in just 16 glorious bars to sum up both the broad legato sweep of Hoagie Carmichael's tune and yet get giddily away from it. Artie Shaw went into music just to make enough money to finish his education. He sold 100 million records and found out it wasn't about the money. For most of its practitioners, the point of jazz is that it's not fixed, it's never the same, it's improvisational. For Shaw, that's what made music frustrating. It's more variable. It's never as fixed as a painting or a novel, as we'll hear him discuss in this interview. He was an odd kind of guy to interview. I think it was Cole Porter who said of the Duchess of Windsor's conversational style that she always returned the ball. Shaw couldn't wait that long. He'd lean over your side of the net and whack it down your throat while you were still serving. I like that about him. Mel Torme said if you were saying anything to Artie Shaw and you pause for breath, you never get a word in for the next 50 minutes. That's pretty much the case. He always liked to talk about the big picture, so you'd ask him about something very specific that happened in 1937, and the next thing you know, he'd be going on about Mozart and Beethoven and Rembrandt and Picasso and Thomas Mann, all over the map. That's what he liked to do, big picture conversation. But he always had plenty to say. I'll give him that. I asked him once about the high notes. I forget what it was now. I think it was concerto for clarinet or something like that. And whether that's difficult. And he told me something that he said to some other musician years ago, who'd asked him about that. Said, "Isn't it scary?" And Shaw goes, "Put your hand on the table," and I did. And he goes, "Now lift up your index finger," and I did. And he said, "There, is that scary?" And this musician said to him, "You mean it's as easy as holding up your finger?" And he said, "If it's not like that, don't do it." The clarinet playing was the easy part. It was everything else that was the problem.
Complain once that people just wanted to hear the same old things over and over. Do you find now, after a period away from them, that you still actually quite like things like Begin the Beginning?
Well, you know the old French saying, le plus ça change, the more it changes, the more it remains the same. It does, it changes, the mood changes, the mode changes, but the people remain the same, public taste remains very largely the same. In terms of its effect on the times, people are generally about 50 to 100 years behind any good artist.
Yeah.
And I don't mean the word artist pompously. I mean a person who's trying to do something that's distinguished from mere entertainment. An artist would like to be entertaining too, but basically he's trying to illuminate some corner of existence in the medium he deals in. For example, in what they call jazz, which is a dreadful word, just as classical is a dreadful word, and what they really mean is non-popular when they say classical. I call it long-form music as opposed to short-form music. Jazz was, for a long time, as you know, a three-and-a-quarter-minute piece that was dictated by techniques. You know, old Oscar Wilde said, nature imitates art. It's true.
Do you think jazz is a lot longer these days? I mean, if you pick up a jazz album these days, there's about four tracks in it.
Sometimes about four times too long. It's all been said in the first minute and a half, and they go on. Now they indulge themselves and get into a lot of repetition. It gets pretty redundant after guys played 12 chords and the same thing that he could have said in two.
It's also become pretty humorless, don't you think?
Yeah, a little solemn rather than serious. And there's a big difference between serious. Serious can be funny. Jack Benny was quite serious sometimes. Elmore Leonard writes quite seriously, but sometimes interesting. I told Clint Eastwood once that, as far as I was concerned, the Dirty Harry was the closest to art he ever got, because that pictures America as it really is, whereas a picture like Bird, which was meant to be a serious thing, was a solemn and boring thing. If you're going to pick an artist who's at odds with his time, you don't pick Charlie Parker. He was worshipped in his lifetime. He just screwed up.
But people do have this image of the kind of tortured jazz musician or the tortured...
Well, some guy asked me, what about that anguished note? I said, you mean that's a high E? Anguished. You know, that's something we read into things. I mean, yes, Van Gogh lived an anguished life, but some of his paintings were absolutely joyful. And they talk a lot about Beethoven's maladjustment. That was when he was chasing countesses. When he wrote the pastoral, he was a happy man. You can hear it in the music.
When you look at some of the things you did in the very early days, just going back to the original A-side of Begin the Beginning, Indian Love Call, which is a really kind of larky version in which Rudolf Frimmel almost gets hip.
We were making fun of that. Yeah. You know, we were sort of joshing it.
Yeah.
I mean, after the Nelson Eddy and Jeanette MacDonald mawkishness, you know, that silliness.
When I'm calling you,
so we made fun of it. We went cheap, cheap, and we did a lot of things like that.
Thank you.
A good record of its kind. I tell you, Fremmel thought it was good. Once he got past his shock.
When I'm calling you, da 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 dee da da, all right, all right. Will you answer to do dee da do dee da da da?
Oh, stop. Oh, stop.
That means I offer my love to you to be your own. If you refuse me, I will be blue and waiting all alone. But when you hear my love call ringing clear,
oh, here, oh,
and I hear your answering echo so dear,
oh, echo, oh, echo,
then I will know our love will come true. You belong to me, I belong to you.
And, you know, audiences like that. As a matter of fact, we thought that was the A side, judging from the responses when we played it in public. And Begin was just tacked on, as I wrote, as an afterthought. I thought, well, it's a nice little tune. It'll make a nice, quiet contrast. But that one took off like a singed cat, you know.
Still possible when you hear it now to remember, because I think you just went along to see the Cole Porter Show Jubilee and you were struck by the tune.
I thought it was a marvelous tune. You see, in those days, you remember, tunes were 32 bars.
Yeah.
There was an 8, 8, bridge, and 8, or A, B, A, C, 8, something else, and then back to the first 8 and something else again. But this tune went on for 104 bars. Repetition of something's been done so often that you know it. When you first heard Mozart, it must have been astounding to the people who heard it. But now we hear it, it sounds all kind of nice and quaint, and isn't it nice? We remember all these diatonic sounds. Well, that's true of everything. See, I tell people, you'll never hear Bix. You'll never hear Louis Armstrong. I heard him the first time in person, and I was astounded. You can't get that from a record. No record can pick up the sound of a live performance. And when you listen to music, basically you're listening to sound. People don't seem to understand that. Never mind what he plays or the millions of notes he can do. That's athletics. That's an Olympic thing. How many notes can I get into a bar? Well, it's like how fast can I traverse 100 yards? It has nothing to do with music. That's exhibitionism. It's look how fast I can move. Look how clever I am. But music is feeling. Somebody said, and it's a good line, a guy played a cascade of notes into his ear, and he said, "That was nice, now sing me a song."
You're also famous for at moments in your career having a go at members of your public, who only ever want to hear Frenesy or Begin.
Yeah, whatever.
Do you think
you're making me laugh? This wasn't the reason I quit the music business.
But here they are. Yet here they are. They still want to hear Begin the Begin.
I don't give a damn what they want to hear. I don't have to play it.
Yes.
I mean, it's like asking Van Gogh to paint the same painting over and over and over. He did it. I did Begin. If you want it, get the record. People say, why did you quit? I say, have you got every record I ever made? Well, no. Well, then get them all and ask me. First, I mean, you know, you can't tell people what to do.
But
it's a great presumption, don't you think?
Frenesy. It was number one for 13 weeks through Christmas 1940, winter, and the early spring of 1941. Artie Shaw had great musicians, Barney Kessel, Buddy Rich, terrific vocalists, Billie Holiday, Helen Forrest, the best arrangers, Jerry Gray, Eddie Sauter. At the height of his fame, he was making $60,000 a week. For the purposes of comparison, George Burns and Gracie Allen were making about one-tenth of that between them. At the time, Shaw's band did a stint as the house orchestra on the Burns and Allen radio show, with Artie serving as Gracie's supposed love interest on the show. The first time he quit the music business, nobody believed him. The record contract, the nightclubs, the radio shows and movies, who'd walk away from all of that? He pleaded insanity. "A guy walks away from $1 million," he said, "wouldn't you call that insane?" He was Artie Shaw. He thought he was big enough to do what he wanted. And every time he walked out on stage, all they wanted was Frenesy and Stardust. He was changing, he was growing, he was moving on, and he thought they'd come along with him on the journey, which, as he saw it, was the point of the exercise.
There's a sequential series of happenings here called music. But that doesn't mean that they're divorced from each other. Each one leads inexorably to the next. And it's like Louis Armstrong came along, and out of him came what we now call jazz. But there was Bix there, too. And then there was Art Tatum there, too. And then along came Charlie Parker and changed that, along with Diz. Before that, however, was Roy Eldridge as a link. Everything is causal.
Yes, but when you talk about jazz, it often seems as if all those developments are taking it away into a little corner, far away from all the
other
music.
Well, the way it's going now, but there are a few practitioners out there that still have an idea that maybe we should do something perceptible, and it doesn't have to sound like broken crockery to be jazz.
Right.
A lot of people seem to think if it doesn't sound bewildering, it's not jazz. You play a melody, God help you. You know, what's wrong with a melody? Especially if it's a good one.
Well, a lot of the things that you've done, I mean, like, you know, like Moonglow, jazz
performers. It's a nice tune.
Yeah, but jazz performers think that sort of sissy stuff now.
Well, right? I don't care what they think. That they're entitled to think whatever they think.
Thank you.
again. It's like saying you're painting black on black, therefore Michelangelo was no good. He's very corny. He painted pictures. What's that got to do with it? Each thing is good in its own terms. We must stop categorizing. It's a disease. Categorize, then you don't have to think about it anymore. We forget that the word definition comes out of the word finite. When you've defined something, you're through with it. You don't have to think about it anymore. Well, it's very convenient to go through life forgetting everything. But there it is. It's still there. And you better remember a little bit. Do a series of lectures, seminars, and they're called Three Chords for Beauty's Sake and One to Pay the Rent. That says it all, doesn't it? One to pay the rent is a fair amount. I don't mind one, but if it's four for the rent, I'm out of here. Hmm. I don't want to do that. It's boring to me. And if I'm bored, my audience will be bored.
Well, I'm sure they won't be bored on Thursday night. In fact, as always with your career, it's been a question of the public sort of sprinting behind trying to keep up
with
you.
Well, you know, some wise man once said, walk at the head of the parade, but not too far ahead.
Yes.
You walk too far and they've turned a corner and you're going down the road. Where are they? So that's what it's about, the life of a public artist. A person who considers himself an artist as opposed to an entertainer. And as they say, the line is blurry. You can get so good as an entertainer that you finally become regarded as an artist. But the difference, say, between a Van Gogh and a Norman Rockwell. Yeah. One is immediately perceptible. He's painting something that's nostalgic, and let's look at the good old days, and I keep saying when Hitler was running around. But anyway, as opposed to another man who's trying to illuminate a corner of existence that you hadn't thought about. One man who took my course, I asked him why they're there first and get them into an argument, get them angry. Step on their pet prejudices and their pet theories. And when it's all over, we get into a large argument. Out of that comes some understanding. At the end of the third seminar, I asked the crew, what did you get out of this? We've been yammering each other here for 3 weeks. And one man said a very good line. He said, you seem to be saying, we passed this way but once, so pay attention.
Yes.
It's very important to pay attention. We don't mostly. You tell people something, they nod, but they don't hear a damn word you said. And 2 minutes later, they got another view of what you said. It's the game of rumor.
Yeah, yeah. I think you're right. But the only thing I'd say to that is that we can undervalue the sort of small art that is disguised art, like Indian Love Call. It's from a corny operetta, but yours is a great recording.
We're back to pay attention again. Romberg, Sigmund Romberg, I did Softly as the Morning Sunrise. Well, he wrote that la 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 for a soprano, and we did it with a beat. And Rami called me and said, "Artie, I heard your record. It's nothing like what I wrote, but I like it." So we play it that way. Creating the melody. I didn't change it to something unrecognizable. Just gave it a different view.
Finding some corner in there.
Yeah, lighting up a little corner. Ideas on paper expressed in symbols called words.
Well, why do you like writing more than music? Because if you talk to most, say, most lyric writers would much rather be composers. They always feel that music is a much purer form.
You see, you're getting off into about five different subjects. Let's deal with one.
Yeah.
First, I don't like writing more than music. I enjoy writing more than I do making music because when I play music, it's gone. That's it. One shot at it, and there it is. It's on the record. Now, you can do it again, but then that's gone. But if you write, you have a piece of paper, and you can tinker with it and fix it and change the nuances until you get it to where it says what precisely what you mean or indicates in such a way that the reader will think precisely what you mean. Writing is a much more exacting form of work, and you can aim at and very occasionally achieve perfection. In playing, where you're improvising, you never achieve perfection. You approximate it. Writing, you can. You can achieve your perfection. It doesn't mean perfect in somebody else's. People say, are you better than? That's a ridiculous. You're not doing a high jump where you can measure who's better. I'm doing the best I can do. I'm being the best me I can be. That's opposed to your you. We're different people. We have different thumbprints, so our work should bear a difference. In terms of the audience,
how close do you think you ever got to perfection then? As far as
I did achieve it, I think once or twice in music, where I hit something that came out of maybe 30 years of experience.
Yeah,
and I can say to myself, hearing that, and I can say to anybody who wants to hear it and's got ears, that's the best you can do. And if you copy it, you won't be doing as well, because that came out of me improvisedly and listened to it.
Yeah.
You can't do it better. I can say truthfully something very few people on earth can say, relatively very few. I did something better than anybody else in the world. I don't mean everything, but some things I did better than anyone in the world. That's quite a thing to be able to say in a world full of people trying.
Do you think, because I think you once said that one of the recordings you were happiest with was These Foolish Things, which...
That cadenza at the end of that, but that record is almost unobtainable now, that particular version of it.
Co-written by a BBC producer, funnily enough.
The tune.
Yes.
Yeah, but the tune doesn't mean anything. It had nothing to do with the tune. What I did at the last 11 bars or 12 bars, I did a cadenza. And when I listened to it later, I said, that is as close to perfection as I'll ever get.
These Foolish Things remind me of you, but that cadenza reminds Artie Shaw of one of the rare moments in his musical career when he came close to achieving perfection. We'll talk more with Artie Shaw in part two of our centennial salute, and we'll hear a lot more great music, including Swonderful, Summertime, Bewitched, Bothered and Bewildered, Dancing in the Dark, and some of Shaw's own compositions, including his Concerto for Clarinet, Summit Ridge Drive, and his song for Billie Holiday, Any Old Time. All that's coming up in part two of our salute to Artie Shaw this weekend at Stein Online.
There's more music and conversation coming up in part two of Mark Stein on the Town.